calling State Affairs to order at 3 o'clock sharp Tuesday, February 28th, 2019, the Max Grunberg Room in the Capitol.
Thursday.
Oh my gosh, we're that close to the weekend. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Wolf?
Yep.
Representative Vance? Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Ledoux? Co-chair Fields?
Here.
Co-chair Chris Tompkins?
Here. With five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Vance is excused today. Would like to welcome Representatives Kopp and Tallarico, who will be presenting, and I think Representative Lincoln will be joining us shortly. Please silence your cell phones, and Representative Ledoux has joined us at 3:01. And a thanks to Martha, as well as her new records apprentice, Julia Bushman, for facilitating the meeting, as well as Madison in the back with the LIO. Three items of business for today: HB 34, sponsored by Representative Tallarico; HB 12, relating to protective orders, by Representative Kopp; and HB 14, sponsored by Representative Lincoln, relating to sexual assault offenses and sentencing aggravators. This is the first hearing for all three bills. As will be the custom, most likely, for this committee, we'll hear public testimony at a latter hearing, and I think it's fair to say that will likely be next week, and also entertain amendments from the committee at that time. So today will be bill presentation, and in the case of HB 34, invited testimony. First item on the agenda, Representative Tallarico, HB 34. Please come forward, put yourself on record, and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I do appreciate the opportunity here to present HB 34 to you today. This legislation amends Alaska Statute 3540 by naming bridge number 506 over the Tok River, and that's at mile 1309 of the Alaska Highway, to be named the Scott Johnson Memorial Bridge. Scott was a person who led from the front. He set very high standards for himself. He graduated from his recruit class as a valedictorian of his class from the academy, and he was assigned to the Fairbanks Patrol. He was also involved with the Special Emergency Response Team, which is known as the CERT team, for 19 years, and held positions of the perimeter team leader, entry team leader, and acting team leader. He was also a canine handler, instructor, and a coordinator. He trained at least 33 dual-purpose and drug detection canine teams throughout the state of Alaska during his career. He also worked for the Alaska Bureau of Investigation. And he, at the age of 36, he was promoted to be a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers. He oversaw patrol shifts and later transferred to the Alaska Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement. He earned at least 43 letters of commendation in his career, including two commendations for honorable service, which is a very high honor for the Alaska State Troopers. Quite unfortunately, Trooper Johnson was lost in the line of duty on May the 1st, 2014, and he had been with the Alaska State Troopers for 23 years. I was interested in this, and there is a companion bill, I should say, in the other body, making a memorial for Scott and his incredible service that he provided for all of the citizens of the state of Alaska in that 23 years. If I could add, Mr. Chair, we also have a document from Brandy Johnson, and I had actually had an opportunity to just recently speak with Representative Story, and I want to make it known that she has graciously provided us this information, and has let me know that if there is quite a bit of public support, she is certainly fine with this. So I do appreciate, Mr. Chair, the opportunity to speak with you, so that we would have a second hearing so that we can gauge what that public support is. And I will say, and I want the committee to know, that if we do get that public support, I think it would be great to move forward. If we don't, I will certainly follow Brandy's wishes, however that works out best, Mr. Chairman. So we're here to answer any questions that you might have, and I do once again thank all of you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Any questions from the committee? At this time, it might be appropriate. Brandy Johnson's online as invited testimony, and We can go ahead and transition to you, Ms. Johnson. If you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your invited testimony.
Hello, my name is Brandy Johnson. Chairpersons and members of the committee, after much self-thought, I have found I must think about policy change beyond myself and what change brings to others. I realize there is not an inadequacy in policy to address here today. I like the fact that the Toke River Bridge is named what it is. The bridge has held that name for many years. Scott and I have floated the river from dawn till dusk, hunting moose from the Glen Highway to the Alcan Highway, ending at the Toke River Bridge. In that same segment of the Toke River, Scott told me stories of camping with his family as a young boy. He and I crossed the bridge twice yearly, traveling to and from Eagle, Alaska during hunting season for at least 18 years prior to him being murdered. We must remember policies that are clearly understood and supported by all factions of the community are respected and formulated in a constructive way. I'd appreciate hearing supportive testimony from the communities that centralize the area of the Toke River Bridge. Testimony from just family, friends, and coworkers limits the space for community participation and tailors the policy to a few individuals. Through public deliberation across all factions, community members will voice their respect for change or no change. Not everybody likes change. Change shouldn't be based on tradition, personal or political gain of groups or individuals. Allowing and encouraging such involvement can be realized in a way that allows the community representatives to become more active members in the policy-making process. After Scott was murdered, I was asked if I was interested in naming a bridge after Scott in Gay Bridge. I was not, based on the location of the bridge. I don't want to drive past the sign with Scott's name and see that it has been shot up with bullets and spray-painted. The disrespect and hurt is terrible. What is going through my child's mind when they see this kind of vandalism? As much as I appreciate the thoughtfulness of the honor, none of these honors take away the pain and loss. If anything, they make it worse for me. This is where I must look beyond myself for others. Scott's job was that of a public servant, and now I have found that his death for many will always be remembered by his job and not the person he was. In conclusion, I support the renaming of the Toke River Bridge to the Scott Johnson Memorial Bridge if there is broad spread community support of the centralized area of the bridge. How our lawmakers measure that support, I will leave to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson, for that testimony. And are there any questions from the committee for Ms. Johnson?
No questions, but a comment, if I may.
Representative Story.
I was really honored to read about Scott Johnson's life here and know more about him as a person and about his work. So I have appreciated that, and I appreciate the intent, and I respect Mrs. Johnson's wish to have more public testimony on this honor.
Thank you, Representative Story and Representative Shaw.
Brandy, I don't know if you remember me. I think it was Scott went through the academy in 1991, if I remember correctly. Representative Laddie Shaw here. And to honor somebody at that level is very meaningful. I was driving with my wife up a California coast one time, and I saw a road sign named after the son of one of my former Navy SEAL teammates, who had died in, gotten killed in Afghanistan. So when you see those, they are very heartfelt and very meaningful. And having known Scott Johnson personally, it would be an honor to actually take the time to drive across the bridge and stop and have that moment of remembrance for somebody as valuable to the community as he was.
Thank you. I've heard that from others.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. Thank you very much, Representative Tallarico. This is the first piece of legislation we'll be hearing this legislature and State Affairs Committee, and glad it could be yours. This bill will be noticed again for next Thursday's hearing, and we'll set an amendment deadline, not that we're necessarily expecting amendments on this legislation, but nonetheless 5 p.m. The day before close of business, 5 p.m. Wednesday. We'll hold the bill at this time and notice public testimony for next Thursday. That takes us to the second item on today's agenda, HB 12 from Representative Kopp, sponsored by Representative Kopp, relating to protective orders. Also the first hearing in this committee. I should note there is a committee substitute that's been distributed to members, and we'll hear an introduction on the bill from Representative Kopp and Mr. Truitt, and entertain a motion to adopt the CS thereafter. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the State Affairs Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill at this time. It was kind of, I have to say, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate the previous bill sponsor bringing forth that bill. Representative Shaw was also my academy instructor in 1988, a few years before Scott Johnson, and he's seen many of us through. And but continuing on the track, sir, of public safety, one of the things I do is I watch Supreme Court opinions because they're always interesting. And how they affect the criminal law. And this last fall, the Supreme Court ruled in a case, Whalen v. Whalen, that victims of domestic violence are not able to get an extension or renewal of an existing protective order, whether that be for domestic violence or sexual assault or stalking, based on the same incident of violence that they originally got the order for. So the decision said it didn't matter if they were still in fear of a continuing violence, continuing domestic violence, continuing sexual assault or stalking, that the ongoing fear didn't matter. It was apparent that our statute did not allow for a renewal if there had already been a protective order issued and expired, unless there was a new act to issue a new order on. On the surface of it, it didn't seem right because, as you can imagine, a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, the last words they heard from somebody is, when you see me again, I'm coming after you, because maybe you sent him to jail based on testimony of you know, being choked or shot at or whatever the situation was. That protective order, for instance, in a stalking or sexual assault is a six-month order. If it's domestic violence, it's a one-year order. Well, when those expire, that doesn't mean that your fear has expired. So what our bill does is it very clearly addresses the Whalen decision, which says that these victims of these incidents may not obtain relief under Title 18, the protective orders, more than once for that incident of violence, regardless of whether they're still in fear. And again, it's because the court said our statutes do not clearly allow for extensions, renewals, or subsequent long-term orders. So what the bill does is it proposes an amendment that allows victims that already have a long-term protective order to request an extension of that order within 30 days of it expiring or up to 60 days after it has expired. So if you have a six-month order, you can get it renewed for another 6 months. If you have a one-year order, it can be renewed for another year. So we are amending two areas of law that deal with domestic violence protective orders and sexual assault stalking protective orders to make it very clear that renewals may happen and you don't have to be a victim again to get the renewal, but based on your continuing fear. Now, a court still has to find it that it is reasonable that you are still in fear of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. We're not denying due process to the accused. The accused still is notified of a hearing at least 10 days in advance, and they are given the opportunity to be heard, testify, and all that. The judge still has to rule that the order is valid, so we're not taking away rights. But we don't want there to be an impediment in the law that would require someone to be a victim again just to get a renewal or an extension. There is a sectional that would like my staff member, Ken Truitt, to walk us through, if you would, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, and Representative Kopp, would the sectional be for the CS versus the original? If so, at that time, I might entertain a motion to adopt the CS as the working document for House Bill 12. Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chairman. I move to adopt CS for House Bill number 12, Work Order 31-LS-0103.
And I would just add backslash S being the ledge legal number. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing and hearing none, the motion carries, and the CS for House Bill 12 is adopted. That takes us to the sectional analysis. Mr. Truitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman and members of the committee. It's great to be here presenting this bill for you today. What I propose to do is just walk through the CS itself, the blank CS / S version that we just distributed to you. And we'll just take it right at the top. So if I can direct your attention to page 1, section 1. This is the Stalking and Sexual Assault Protective Order statute. Subsection E, starting on line 4, this is the very last subsection of the existing statute, and you can see what we're proposing to do there. It's a very short subsection, and we're breaking it into, proposing to break it into three separate sections. The proposed new paragraph number 1, that really is just preparing the existing statute for a list that then follows. The new proposed subsection 2, beginning on line 7. This is essentially the operative fix to the Whelan problem, as Whelan described the problem. So it is instructing the court that they may not deny a petition for protective order solely because the act that gave rise to the initial protective order is the same one that they're seeking the extension for. And number 3 is a new proposed policy for protective orders. And you see the language there that a court may not deny to issue a protective order solely because the court had previously found that the petitioner was a victim of stalking or sexual assault, but the court declined to order relief under the section. So, for the most part, what is in this bill is very tightly drafted, very narrowly focused to just fix the Whelan issue, except for this is a proposed new policy for protective orders. But other than this, everything that's in the bill just keeps the protective order policy as everybody thought it was before the Whelan decision. So section 2 is the how of this bill would be implemented in practice, and it provides the process. And I would draw your attention to, straight away on line 12, you see the within 30 days of the expiration or 60 days after the expiration. The other operative provision of this bill is on line 13, and it's the clause that starts or extended under this section. That language in there instructs that there isn't a limit to just one extension, if that makes sense. So you could get more than one extension. So this answers the Whelan question of, well, what happens if you get an extension and then what? This provision, the extended under this section, kind of instructs that the extensions aren't limited to just one. What follows in the rest of this section is really just the notice to the petitioner, the respondent, and holds that the court, the judge still needs to exercise the discretion. There's nothing in here that alters the preponderance of evidence standard that is included within the statute, so there's no change. So the petitioners would still need to meet the preponderance of the evidence standard in convincing the judge, the court, to issue the order, and the court would still have to make a determination based on what the petitioner is bringing forward. And pretty much that's the bill, really. Sections 3 and 4 are just the identical provisions, but they are seeking to amend the domestic violence protective order statute. Section 5 is the applicability clause that just makes it clear that should this become law, it will affect existing domestic violence orders and anything issued on that date of effectiveness and all orders after. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Truitt. Questions from the committee, and first in line, Representative Ledoux.
How come these orders are not issued for a reasonably lengthy time, as of course, in the criminal proceedings? I mean, these are protective orders, which I think are, even though they might involve some sort of criminal action by the respondent, I believe they are within the civil jurisdiction of the court. So somebody's been jailed, for example, for domestic violence, for sexual assault, for stalking, etc. Why doesn't the court just issue these orders?
So that's a good, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, good question. So there are ex parte protective orders, which are 20-day orders issued without presence of the offender, hence ex parte. The court can issue those for 20 days to protect someone pending a hearing. There's an emergency 72-hour order that just a police officer can say, Judge, this person is in terrible trouble. I need a protective order right now. And 72 hours basically to get more evidence to come and get a longer hearing. But what we're talking about here are the long-term protective orders. And those are set in state statute probably for about 40 years, going back to 1865. Why the legislature said it's 6 months for stalking, sexual assault, or 1 year for domestic violence, I'm not sure how we arrived at that. But probably at that time, looking at the legislative history, there's probably, you know, a lot of legal reasons, arguments laid out. I believe those are fairly standard from state to state, how we came to 1 year protective orders in certain situations, 6 months in others. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I you know, those lengths of time have been in our statutes for decades. I don't know what exactly the legislative history is behind how we got to the length of those protective orders. The court does issue them, and because they are the determine whether there's probable cause to restrain someone from occupying their property or communicating, and there's the due process set up where the petitioner and the respondent both get to make their case in those long-term orders.
Follow-up?
And very quickly, for the record, 1965, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
So these might be in situations where somebody has accused somebody else of sexual assault but hasn't made a report with the police?
So for a long-term protective order, I would say we'd have to have someone from the court here to answer this definitively. Great. I mean, they should answer that definitively, but I would think it would be profoundly unusual for a court to issue an order, a sexual assault protective order, unless there was some type of a formal report made. I wouldn't say it wouldn't happen, but I would say it would be out of the ordinary.
Can we hear from the court?
Absolutely. Yeah. Representative Crawford, would be all right if we called Nancy Mead from the court system. Thanks for joining us. Ms. Mead, please put yourself on the record, and if you wouldn't mind, respond to Representative Ledoux's question.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And I believe the question was limited to the protective orders that are requested for sexual assaults as opposed to domestic violence.
We could have both of them. I could hear on both of them if you...
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, protective orders for sexual assaults are relatively rare compared to those for domestic violence protective orders. And you're right, these are completely civil proceedings. It's just a couple at home, because we'll go with domestic violence. There has to be a household relationship between the people. have a dispute, and they come to the court. There's no district attorney involved. There's no one like that involved, and it's just citizen versus citizen. They're civil proceedings, and if the court finds by a preponderance the evidence that there was a crime of domestic violence and that the order is necessary, they will issue it. So then your question becomes, well, if there's a finding by a court of a crime of domestic violence, where does the criminal law come into it? And I think that's what you're getting at. And the fact is that the victim in that scenario, or they aren't really considered a victim per se, but more the petitioner, can report the incident to the police, but they don't usually do that, as a matter of fact. We have far more citizens seeking domestic violence protective orders than criminal cases against the person for the crime of domestic violence. And the crime of domestic violence is kind of a funny phrase. There are about eight different crimes that that make up domestic violence. It can be trespassing on a person's property if they're a household member, or vandalism, you know, throwing the plate or breaking something on the front lawn or something like that. So to be a little bit more direct, sexual assault, I believe Representative Kopp is quite correct, that it would be quite unusual for the court to issue a sexual assault protective order because they're making a finding that there was a crime of sexual assault, which is a distinct thing as opposed to domestic violence, which can be one of many things. And I think in almost all those cases, there is a corresponding criminal case for the sexual assault.
Follow up?
And where there is a corresponding criminal case for the sexual assault, would the court issue, the criminal court, in the criminal case, issue an order on its own?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the court wouldn't sua sponte on its own just decide to issue an order. But sometimes in the criminal case, one of the bail conditions, for example, if the person released, would be no contact with the victim. That's actually very common in a lot of criminal cases as a bail order, so pretrial. And then perhaps at sentencing, the person has time in jail, so you don't need any no contact order. And then again, at the other end of the criminal proceeding during probation, the court can order during probation not to have contact with a victim as well. So that can happen in appropriate circumstances, and it does sometimes.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl, question for Representative Kopp or Ms. Mead?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think most of my questions are pretty much answered. I guess the discrepancy between 6 months and a year and there was some historical basis on that, and I was just sort of curious. And the other question I had, which was also answered, is could these be successively extended, renewed, so to speak? And the answer is yes, pending a approval of a judge, I'm assuming.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, as Mr. Truitt said, that is certainly the intent of the wording in the bill, and so the bill would provide for subsequent extensions.
Well, the historical 6 months and a year, is there?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I believe that's based on federal standards, that it is fairly consistent across states because, of course, there's that balance of limiting in many ways the liberty of the respondent in these cases for longer than is necessary, and in most, if not all, cases, the petitioner's fear is abated after 6 months or a year, and you know, as Representative Kopp is saying, if not, they can come back.
Thank you. I guess my question was that domestic violence is a 1 year protective order, whereas sexual assault is 6 months, and I guess that was is there a historical reason for that?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think that was changed during 2004, and it did used to be a six-month time period for the domestic violence protective orders, and then through a federal act, it might have been the Violence Against Women's Act or something along those lines, states generally went towards the 1 year, and Alaska was one of those states that did that, I believe, in 2004.
Representative Story.
On another issue.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Is there a question about this bill?
Yes.
Have at it. Whatever issue it might
be. Yes. Thanks. Yes. In Section 1, line 5 of the bill, It talks about a lapse of time between an act of sexual assault and the filing. I know this is also to take care of stalking. Should it be, in this case too, a lapse of time between stalking and an act of sexual assault? Should that be added to the language?
So that, through the chair, co-chairs, Representative Story, we have, in our discussions with Ledge Legal, stalking is a little tougher because it refers to a course of conduct that occurs over a period of time. It's never like one thing that happens that creates stalking. It's many individual things that collectively put you in fear, and there is actually, the legal definition indicates there's a process over time that occurred that sum up to the summation of now we have stalking. And because it is not specific event oriented, but a course of conduct oriented, that is why it was drafted in this matter. It would probably be good to, you know, to get the further commentary direct from them, but I know that's the best way I can explain it.
Follow up.
So I would think that there could be a lapse of time someone stalks you, then for whatever reason continues stalking you after a lapse of time. That was just my comment.
Yes, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Story, this is Ken Truitt, for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That particular section, the language that you're talking about, is from the existing statute, and we're, the draft before you was not proposing to make any alteration to the existing language. We're just adding language, not changing what was already there, if that helps explain also.
Follow up?
I don't see where, on that line, I don't see where it has stalking language.
Through the chair, Representative Story, so I am fully supportive of making this as inclusive as possible, mm-hmm. just to be clear.
Yeah.
Our discussion with Ledge Legal is there was a drafting issue with adding it at this point because of the event-specific nature of a crime of assault versus the way that we have defined stalking in the law, which is a course of conduct which occurs over a period of time.
Okay.
And it just was problematic. And because I wasn't trying to change all of the policy on the way the law was written, but more address the Whalen decision, but I'm empathetic with the point you raise, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Story, we don't have legislative legal online, otherwise we could ask them to share perspective, but perhaps next hearing.
Sure.
Any further questions?
No.
Other members of the committee? Seeing none. The co-chair and I will confer, but I think this bill will be back before the committee next Thursday, perhaps with an opportunity for amendments, certainly with public testimony, and we'll be in touch with the sponsor on next steps.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of that committee. Thank you.
And that takes us to the third item on today's agenda, HB 14, an act relating to sexual assault, sex offenses, and sentencing aggravators, sponsored by Representative Lincoln. Representative Lincoln, welcome. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and present or overview the piece of legislation, and maybe after introductory comments we can entertain a motion to adopt the CS and take it from there.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Lincoln, representative for District 40. I'm joined by Chief of Staff Rose Foley, who will introduce herself a bit later when she goes through the sectional. HB 14 is a bill that classifies the act of ejaculating on a person without their consent as a sex crime, and recognizes a serious nature of strangulation to the point of unconsciousness by classifying the act as a first-degree assault and including it in a list of aggravating factors for sentencing. Last fall, a lot of us became aware of an incident in the state that's highly publicized where a person strangled a woman to unconsciousness and ejaculated on her without her consent. With this bill, that act could be prosecuted as a sexual offense. It also acknowledges the seriousness of strangulation. Strangulation is prevalent in domestic violence incidents, and 56% of women murdered in Alaska in 2017 were killed by an intimate partner. A study published by the Journal of Emergency Medicine found that a prior non-fatal strangulation increases a woman's likelihood of becoming a homicide victim by 700%, and non-fatal strangulation preceded 43% of domestic homicides. This bill recognizes the gravity of strangulation as a precursor to future violent crimes. I'd like to thank a couple organizations, 49th Rising, No More Free Passes, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Public Defender's Office, Department of Law, Ledge Legal, and the bill's co-sponsors, Reps Klayman, Field, Sponholz, Tarr, Tuck, Zolkowski, Hopkins, and Drummond. Our office has treated creating and modifying this bill as a collaborative effort. It's gone through a couple of iterations, and to that point, I think I would appreciate if the committee would consider adopting the CS. It's the most up-to-date version of the bill.
Absolutely. And at this time, I'd entertain a motion to adopt the CS for House Bill 14.
I move to adopt the CS for House Bill 14. That's work order number 31-LS0182/E/E.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the CS for House Bill 14 is adopted. I think that can take us into the sectional analysis. Or maybe I should ask quickly, would any member of the committee request a summary of changes between the committee substitute and the original version of HB 14? Seeing and hearing none, perhaps we can just go right into the sectional analysis. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You should have a sectional analysis of version E in your packets, and we can walk through that. Section 1 classifies strangulation to the point of unconsciousness as assault in the first degree. Section 2 clarifies that a dangerous instrument in relation to strangulation includes hands and other body parts, such as the forearm or foot. Section 3 includes contact with ejaculate in the definition of sexual contact. Section 4 adds strangulation to the point of unconsciousness to the list of aggravating factors that can be considered at sentencing, and Section 5 is an applicability section.
Questions from the committee on House Bill 14? Just pause a few more moments. Any closing comments from the sponsor?
None other than I'm happy to work with the committee on any sort of amendments or changes you'd like to see.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of buy-in from the committee on the piece of legislation. This bill will be back before us next week for a second hearing, for public testimony, for committee action, and for amendments. Stay posted on specifics, but seeing no committee questions, that concludes our business for the day. Thank you, Representative Lincoln.
Thank you.
We'll be back next Tuesday, March 5th. Thank you, Martha, Madison, Julia, and at 3:39, we're adjourned.